You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes.
Some would like us to believe that this episode of After Images is our 17th, but that would be telling. It's a podcast, not a number. We are now going to the village to explore the ins and outs of the 1967 British television series The Prisoner, created by Patrick McGowan. Imprisoned in a strange coastal village whose exact location appears to defy reason, McGowan plays the role of an intelligence agent who has recently resigned and been kidnapped. He is now known as Number 6 in this baroque environment where everyone's identity is a number. The forces ruling the village want Number 6 to give them information about why he resigned, but he resolutely refuses to reveal any information and does his very best to escape this open-air prison. The village's Number 2, or second-in-command, keep rotating, each one devising a new Machiavellian plan to extract information from Number 6. For his part, Number 6 keeps wondering, who is Number 1? Brilliantly shot and edited, replete with political and philosophical undertones, The Prisoner is one of the best television series to have ever reached our screens. On this episode of After Images podcast, we welcome Gary Lachman.
Gary Lachman is the author of many books about consciousness, culture, and the Western esoteric tradition, including Dreaming Ahead of Time, The Return of Holy Russia, Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Age of Trump, Lost Knowledge of the Imagination, and Beyond the Robot, The Life and Work of Colin Wilson. He has written biographies of Carl Gustav Jung, Madame Blavatsky, Rudolf Steiner, Emanuel Swedenborg, P.D. Ouspensky, and Aleister Crowley. He writes for several journals in the U.S., U.K., and Europe, lectures around the world, and his work has been translated into more than a dozen languages. In a former life, he was a founding member of the pop group Blondie, and in 2006 was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Before moving to London in 1996 and becoming a full-time writer, Lachman studied philosophy, managed a metaphysical bookshop, taught English literature, and was science writer for UCLA. He is an adjunct professor of transformative studies at the California Institute of Integral Studies. He can be reached at garylachman.com or on Facebook or Twitter.
Gary Lachman, we are delighted to have you with us today on After Images podcast to speak about The Prisoner.
Well, it's absolutely a pleasure to join you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thanks for being here. And we usually like to begin with the question, why did you choose The Prisoner? What does it mean to you?
Well, when Frank first got in touch with me, just in general, what would I be interested in doing? I said in general, sort of, what about these 1960s British sort of spy or, you know, espionage kind of pop, you know, programs like The Avengers, Danger Man was one, Man in a Suitcase, and then The Prisoner. And then he said, well, let's just do, you know, we try to focus on one thing, so let's just do The Prisoner. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I just remember it. I mean, I grew up with that on television. So I was, and I was about 12 years old, I think. Yeah, I was 68, so I would have been about 12. So this is in New Jersey, 1968. And it's probably around, it's probably the same year. I know I went with my father to see 2001. And his reaction as we walked out was, what the hell was that all about? So we had absolutely no idea. So I'm sure I didn't quite get it at the time when I saw it, because it wasn't, it certainly wasn't like Man from U.N.C.L.E. or, you know, the other spy. I mean, The Avengers, I also was like, what, The Avengers? What? No, that's a comic book with Captain America. And then I realized, oh, no, I guess you can't copyright a title. So, and I always liked that, like, you know, Steen and Mrs. Peel. Just that whole period, I have nostalgia for it because I grew up then. And then I subsequently wrote a book about the 1960s, not specifically about The Prisoner or anything like that, but about how much of the pop culture at that time was influenced by rather strange occult or mystical ideas. I don't know if The Prisoner kind of floats in there at all. But there is, you know, some in places we could say, I mean, not necessarily a cult in any way like that, but certainly sort of, you know, ideas about identity and consciousness and all that. And then there's the strange, you know, the Christian be seeing you sort of thing, you know, which maybe at a stretch you might, you know, I was thinking, oh, can we link that to a kind of Gnostic kind of, you know, because he's living in a false world. You know, and that's sort of the early Christians. I say this because the early Christians, well, the very early Christians around the same time before the Petrine Church took over, the one that McGowan himself, you know, was, you know, very much a firm believer in, you know, he was a very staunch Catholic. So the Gnostics would have been the bad guys because they were this heretical sect who it was rather than believe in Jesus as the literal person, this happened to him and he saved you. It's like, no, we all go through this kind of transformative experience in some way, and gnosis in the sense of having true spiritual knowledge. And but they, you know, there was competition in the early days, and I somehow wondered, maybe just unconsciously, he not that he thought of it, because I'm not seeing that reference in there at all, although the reference to living in a simulated world or unreal world or something, which we're all very familiar with today, but back then was strange. But that is something that the early Gnostics of the Christian time talked about. So I don't know. This is very left field, but that I was just, in any case, that's basically, I just grew up during that time when this prisoner was, you know, something that was on television. Back in the day when you had to be at a certain place at a certain time in order to watch something too. So it was a very, very different experience than today. You know, you had to be, it was in the old Cartesian grid. You know, you had to be in a certain space and time to be able to watch this program. So very strange sort of thing. My children who, well, they're not children anymore. They're in their 20s now, but they grew up not, that's not like that. So any case, yeah. So I had a, you know, a personal childhood, you know, interest in that stuff, and then subsequently I wrote about it, so that's pretty much why it came to me.
Do you think this TV series could have been created at another moment in time than the 1960s?
No, I think it's very, very 1960s. I mean, it reminds me of other things in that period, like the film The Tenth Victim with Mastroianni. And was it Ursula Andress? Strange dystopian science fiction film where murder is a sport and all of that's fit. But it's very pop. It has all that. I mean, people today is, oh, this is art house. You know, it's like, no, it's a science fiction film from the 60s, but they call it art house. And so it shares with that. And then, you know, I guess like Fahrenheit 451 and things of that sort. So no, it's very 60s. And I think it bends. I think the last few episodes kind of say, well, this is really, we get into kooky 60s world, and it's kind of, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's annoying. Sometimes it's like, oh yeah, well, he's getting away with stuff on, you know, primetime television and in America too. You know, it is very, very strange. Because that's one of the things I think today, I mean, I've lived in London now for quite some time, and I've gone back and watched both, you know, The Prisoner and The Avengers and Man in the Suitcase, but also, you know, Man from U.N.C.L.E. and I Spy and some of the other Mission Impossible and this, I mean, something like Man from U.N.C.L.E. I really loved when I was a kid, but it doesn't hold up for me today when I watch those episodes. I mean, I like Ilya Kuryakin, and he gets the black, you know, turtleneck, and, you know, Robert Vaughn's a bit suave, you know, chauvinist sort of, but the British ones tend to have, there's something more happening. I don't know what it is. It's a little more intelligence. And I mean, The Avengers too is another series which, like, you know, Danger Man, I mean, in America that was Secret Agent Man, but in Danger Man it's black and white and it's rather grim and gritty. Maybe later episodes, I mean, like the last few that were in color, Hiroshi, and it's got a bit more of the poppy element in it. But The Avengers started out, you know, like that, you know, the ones, early ones with Honor Blackman, you know, and then you get Emma Peel, then it in color, and then it's like it's pop land, you know, it's, you know, the Carnegie Row and the psychedelics hit sort of in a way, and everything gets very strange. So it's all, you know, part of that kind of blend. So I don't think, and I'm very, very glad no one's, or there hasn't, or I think there has been a couple attempts at remakes, but they're not particularly successful. I mean, that Avengers film was dreadful. I mean, I remember I did watch it some years ago. It was absolutely dreadful. So no.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned counterculture, and I hope we'll come back to that theme. But just maybe continuing on the theme of the series of the era, I'm thinking a lot about Danger Man and the links to that and The Prisoner, and that in some ways they feel like one continuation, even though there are marked differences, of course, and one of the major ones being from going in black and white to color. But knowing that Port Marion, the location of The Prisoner, already featured in one of the Danger Man episodes, and the fact that Patrick McGoohan was the leading man, how do you read the links between the two series? Do you see continuation between them, or do you really think of them as distinct projects?
No, I mean, I assume in some way it is Drake, but I understand that they don't, you know, there's different reasons they say, you know, the royalties they would have had to pay, you know, Ralph Smart, is it, the royalties. And also, you know, we're not sure whether number six is a spy or not. I mean, Alex Cox, I read his book about the series, and he's sort of, I mean, he's, I don't want to give it away, but he says, no, he's a rocket scientist, you know. And that's what he is. And, you know, and so, and I think even McGoohan said in some interview that, you know, Drake would have got out of Port Marion much, much earlier than blah, 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 blah. But then there are scenes where he's like, he's, you know, he's very physical. I mean, he doesn't get most rocket scientists. I mean, not that I know too many, but you don't get the impression that they can beat up a couple of the guys, you know, after and you know, engage successfully in Khonshu and things of that sort. So I don't know. But I guess that's all part of it. I mean, that's like, don't give it away. I mean, it is or it isn't or isn't it? But that's whole part of what the idea of the person is about. You're unsure. I mean, it was very much ahead of its time in the sense that the whole epistemological uncertainty under which we have been living for the last, you know, decade at least, at least widely in the public, I would say that has been the case in the higher kind of levels of academia for a long time. Around the same time, maybe, as The Prisoner was coming out, right? You get, you know, postmodernism beginning, you get, you know, Foucault and Derrida and the whole sort of idea that, you know, reality is very ambiguous, it isn't stable and all this kind of thing. So I'm not saying there's a connection, but there is a sort of, that academic version of it was way in the background. It took some time for it to trickle down. That's what I call trickle down metaphysics, trickle down to the mainstream. But, you know, McGoohan and The Prisoner, he was dealing with that already. The ambiguity there's no easy answer. You don't really know. I mean, that's the whole thing I came away with thinking, like, okay, well, yeah, you know, at the end, what happens? You know, was it all for him to get up higher up in the echelons of this, you know, place that he was in some way? Has he now like become part of it, but in a position of power? You know, we don't quite know. And I think, you know, that could have been a lucky hit. We got to get this thing done, guys. Okay, lock the door. I got the champagne. I'm going to write this thing and just pick it up in the morning. Okay, that's it. This is what happens, you know. And it's like, oh, well, it doesn't really gel. That's perfect. That's exactly what the show's about. So, you know, or it was all planned. But I think we come away not knowing. It's a very effective. I think he introduced a kind of a very radical ambiguity into popular, you know, media that normally doesn't accept that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I find that interesting that Umberto Eco's book, The Open Work, was published right around the same time that The Prisoner was released. And this is before, of course, he went on to become celebrated for Semiotics. He was really looking at this kind of modernism that encouraged interactivity and had this level of ambiguity where it was up to the reader or the viewer to really think about and interact with the work of art and form their own ideas. And he always links that to a kind of countercultural movement of trying to break up or go against some kind of pre-existing barrier. So I just wonder what you think about that. You've already mentioned a little bit that, you know, your own interpretation or what the ending made you think of, but I'm just wondering what kind of tools you've used to think about the show, especially with your background in different Jungian.
Usually half a bottle of whatever I could afford that evening, and say, okay, I kept it to one, watching one again an evening. So no, I just watch. I mean, I'm not really trying to, deconstruct it or anything like that. It's sort of, as I said, I mean, first time I saw it was 1968 when I was about 12 years old, and then when I've was living here over the years, I started collecting, DVDs and things of that, those ancient sorts of things. And I got those and all that in the Avengers, and I started, watching these things, which I hadn't seen, in quite some time. I mean, ITV had the Avengers on or something like that. So, I was remembering, oh, how much I enjoyed these, and and how they were just intelligent and I don't know. They did a lot with a little, whereas I think a lot of the shows in the States, you had a bigger budget and all that, but they come away not quite as interesting anymore. I mean, nostalgia's sake, but they don't. I'm not saying, oh yeah, well, that's real. No, but when I was watching these, so no, it's very naive. I mean, I'm not. I wouldn't. Consider myself, a semiotician or anything like that. I'm just watching it again and thinking, and there is obviously the change. When what is it? The less. Four, the first 13 more or less are kind of, in the genre. Mark Stein, wanted to keep it in, but then that fissures, and then they go off into this other, theater of the absurd, kind of land. And yeah, McGoohan. I mean, I read a biography of him. I think it's Rupert Booth, I think. And I mean, he comes across as a very serious individual, very earnest, a real actor. And I think he had a real serious intent to do something different. I guess, I don't know, I guess with the success of Danger Man, I mean, because I watched that as Secret Agent Man. And again, one of the links between the two is it's in the States, it's a Johnny Rivers theme, but they've given you a number and taken away your name. It's a, there's a man who leads a life of danger, and it's a fantastic rock, it's one of the great rock tunes. It's a TV credit, it's the theme song for a TV show, but it's actually one of the great rock guitar lines. It's up there with the James Bond theme and all that. But he even says they've, given you a number and taken away your name. So that's a link between the two shows. But there was a different, that was a different show to me, because it's like he doesn't beat people up like, or he's not shooting the guns all the time as the other guys doing all that. It's he's using his brains most of the time, which was like Mission Impossible in a way, which was to me the States, it was kind of like that, because Mission Impossible, again, they're not, it's not beating them up and shooting and running and chasing a lot. It's like, okay, this we have to, create a situation here. We want this to happen, so this is the situation we have to create in order to make this happen. So that it was a more intelligent sort of approach, and Danger Man was sort of like that as well. And he's always a different person too, even though he's John Drake. When he goes into these different things, he adopts a new. It's not like James Bond. It's not one of the other shows that I liked at the time, but as if it was the Saint, the Roger Moore. And when I'm watching that recently, one of the fantastic things is wherever he goes, somebody knows. Hey, isn't that something? Wherever he is, it's like somebody, somebody at the newsstand who's, whatever, some ordinary person, which is it's just such a strange kind of theme or motif. It's like, yes, but with Drake, he's a different character. He adopts a different identity. Even there, he's sort of anonymous in the way that Number Six is anonymous, it's a similar kind of situation there. And they also have the shots, opening shots, where he's driving around. The later, I know I, the later series, I think when it went to 50 minutes of the Danger Man. And I think in the States they also, they didn't have the Johnny Rivers anymore, and they had this I forget who did the that theme music, but it's with like a harpsichord. It's partaking of this kind of Sergeant Peppery, if you know what I mean. There was a certain period in the mid 60s when kind of 1910 sounding or older sounding kind of music somehow was part of the psychedelic kind of thing, and it was this other theme, and it's showing most of the time, you know, not in the Lotus, but in a, it's like a Mini or something, I don't know, but he's driving around and he's like in Trafalgar Square or something like that. So there's similar, you know, echoes between the two. So I'm sure, you know, I would think, if you ask me, yeah, it's the same character, but for a couple different reasons. Some negative, we don't want to have to pay to use the name. Some, well, okay, we don't use the name, then that's never make it clear whether it is him or not, and keep that as a motif. You know, that's part of the ambiguity. Yeah. We don't know who he is. You know, he doesn't know who number one is, and that, but we don't really know who number six is. You know, and obviously that's a theme that gets played. You know, we're on a couple episodes, he doesn't know who he is, and he isn't him. He's the you know the in the. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. You know, it's he's in a different body and all that, you know. So yeah, I mean, all those kinds of doubling and sorts of things, once you start thinking about it, you can see them there. So
Yes, this notion of identity is fundamental in The Prisoner, to the extent that one wonders if he truly knows himself who he is, as we find out in the last episode.
I guess that's, you know, and again, this is kind of this is a common theme for us with all the Philip K. Dick movies and all that, but it's well in advance. And it would have been something that would have been more, you would have found it more in, you know, avant-garde theater, you know, or off Broadway or something like that, you know, or an existential, it's an existential kind of, you know, characters, all these questions of identity and freedom. Are we free? Is it really, what would it mean? What does freedom mean? In the context of, you know, where he is, you know, is he ever free in the end? Again, one of the last few things, when the door opens and the butler's there, and it's all like, okay, well, now you're back in London, back home, but it's pretty much, you know, it's a home that seems to resemble the place you just left. And you've worked really hard to get here too. You know, you've been through a lot to get back here too. And I mean, it's very symbolic, the ending, you know, where I mean, the whole thing's symbolic, but I mean, in a very kind of immediate way, where, you know, the kind of what do you want to call it? The sort of top-hatted, tuxedoed hippie, you know, character. He's trying to hitch a ride, and you know, can't get one on one side, so he goes to the other side of the road. He's on the road, you know. He's sort of, you know, maybe a beat kind of character. Anywhere, man. I don't mind. But the other two have more of a, you know, a direction where they want to go. And they both sort of, I guess, Leo McKern picks up his, you know, career. He goes on to be Rumpel. You know, Bailey down the line. I've always liked his acting. He's one of my favorite films, you know, The Day the Earth Caught Fire. If you know that early 60s one, he wears these enormous black round glasses. He looks, it's just like, where did they find those, you know, in that film? But he goes, you know, he's back in Whitehall or wherever, you know, something like that. And likewise, Peter Smith or whoever he is goes home, but he's got a butler. He's got an automatic door. So,
and I think it comes up to the question if the village is actually a place, or if it is more or than a place, if it is a concept.
Well, it's sort of a microcosm of, you know, the larger, you know, context. I mean, one of the things that makes it absolutely 60s is like you could have the same setup without all the strange, you know, banners and you know, clothes and, you know, all that kind of thing. So that, you know, they could just be wearing whatever. If it's a holiday place, you could just be, you know, different people wearing t-shirts and sneakers and, you know, whatever like that. But it is sort of that, I'm just going to say, that's one of the things I think, well, you know, that's what makes it kind of a 60s, you know, that kind of, you know, immediate kind of style choice. But yeah, you know, it is I forgot. How did I? What was the question you asked? That
I don't know if it was exactly your question. I think it was more. I was noting the fact that the village.
Is the village a place? I would say it's a microcosm of because it's a bigger village. You know, when he goes back into London or the world now.
The global village.
That was in the common vernacular at the time, the notion of the global McLuhan and all that, the global village. So yeah, I mean, I guess that's the thing. Even in the interviews I've read, doing a bit of homework on this, Gouin always leaves it ambiguous, and he always says, and he even says he questions the whole idea of freedom. You know, we think we're free, but how are we? At the same time, I think he's someone who. The impression I get was that he valued his own freedom very much. He took a lot of chances in that world, maybe demanding certain things. I mean, he gave up James Bond. I mean, would he have been good at James Bond? I don't know. I mean, I wonder, maybe he would have been, I don't know. But Connery went on to, I guess you could say a larger career than Gouin did after The Prisoner, although he was in some films, not in the same thing. So he's somebody who decided things for himself. So there's a certain kind of freedom that he exercised. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's more of a warning, like don't take your freedom for granted. It's something that you have to question. Again, which is the existential sort of thing. We fall, to bad faith or something. We fall into some form of complacency and accept things. This is how it is. This is what they say. This is how it is, rather than like, well, no, actually, I'm burdened with the responsibility of making choices. It's very attractive to give that, obligation over to someone else. But if I want to actually exercise my freedom, I have to take that on and that sort of thing. And it seems maybe that's the message. Maybe it's a wake-up call to that. That's what I came away kind of thinking, don't take it for free. Yeah, I've escaped the village, but you can take the prisoner out of the village, but you can't take the village out of the prisoner, maybe, because then he's brought it back, to bigger village. So it's a kind of warning, I would say.
And are there particular episodes among the 17 episodes that we see, plus the one alternate episode that we now have access to? I won't say do you have one, because I think it's too hard to choose just one. Do you have several that really stand out to you that are personal favorites?
I thought the Schizoid Man one was, this is dealing with the whole identity kind of thing. And then convoluted, where he's trying to convince them that he's the other guy, trying to convince them that he's him, sort of thing. So you get all those different layers, and that theme gets played out there. And Chimes and Big Ben too. I thought that the whole relationship between him and the woman, the other, one who's trying to escape. And there's that fantastic scene where they're in the box and they've got the partition between them, but it's a very, very intimate kind of scene. But again, that's the same, do we ever really connect with the other, in that way? Or are we always separated in our own compartment? Do we ever, and again, all the relationships that he forms with people there turn out to be not, but again, when is that not the case? They're not necessarily they turn out to be false, but they turn out to be different than you think they may be and all that. And this is so, the ones with Leo McKern, I also, because I think he and McGowan really worked well together. They have certain, they both have an intensity, I would say, in times. I don't know. I was going to be cliche and say McKern's sort of Shakespearean, but I don't know if Gouin isn't as well. But there is this kind of broader kind of thing about, with Leo McKern in times. And I think, Gouin's kind of this granite kind of thing all the time. He's just really hard. He's really, really hard. Although, reading this biography of him, apparently he did comedy well. And you know, some of the when he was in Rep and all of that. So it's yeah, I mean those episodes I found. I mean, so there's the early one, and then there's the what is it, the last two, I guess. It's when you know he's subject to degree absolute, which sounds like something that sounds like something the Inquisition would, you know,
It's not
okay,
orange
we have
alert,
put this off as long as possible, but now it's unavoidable. It's degree absolute, and it's like knock down, drag out. This is it, you know. And again, the whole other thing too, like the whole the end of that, where they're driving away, right, in the thing that's a cage, right? But it's taking them to their freedom. So they're driving away in a cage from the village they've escaped, but it's what's so again, it's all. And what it's done is how many years later? It has us here talking about it, you know, and asking these kinds of questions. And it was a pop TV show too, you know.
It's fascinating how this show was so entertaining and so philosophical at the same time that you could anyway analyze it from a philosophical perspective, even while on the surface it was so popish
And accessible.
and accessible too. And I was wondering, we talked about the fact that it is very ingrained in the 1960s, but according to you, what would be an interesting way to transfer this show to our times? Because, you know, it has so much about trust and paranoia. What would that be in the context of the 21st century with the internet, with conspiracy theories, and so on and so forth?
Well, I mean, as I said, we live in a world with the where all that's rife now. That's part and parcel of our, you know, people born in, I don't know, 2000 or whatever, grow up with that. You know, it's not strange. When this was on, it was strange. Even though it was the 60s and there was all the, you know, weird, you know, but it was still sort of like this was a bit stranger than even, you know, as I said, it was something that you would find more on, you know, off Broadway, you know, theater, avant-garde theater, then, you know, how to go out of your way to find maybe rather than on television. And even with, you know, when you have TV shows portraying the hippies and taking drugs, it's all rather, you know, it's all toned down and all that kind of thing. It isn't really disruptive. It was a way for, you know, the mainstream public culture to absorb that and make part of it and maybe neutralize it in some way. But this was different. But now we live in a world that's all like this. I mean, I've written about this in some of my books and how we, you know, the whole idea, the whole reality, non-reality, you know, truth, false, you know, the real thing and the simulation, all that, the barrier between the two is completely permeable and perforated, and the two is sliding into it. And we, you know, it's part of, I mean, AI, everything. We live in a world that's like very all this. Well, I think in many ways, you know, it's probably cliche, but shows like The Prisoner and other movies in the 70s and where the whole rise of the computer and the computer gets out of control and, you know, blah 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 and takes over and all that kind of stuff. It's like this is pre-echoes of where we are. I mean, is where we are now, did it was this sort of seeing it in advance, or did it give us the blueprint to make that happen? Like, okay, oh, it could be like this. Oh yeah, not that we want to do it to make all the bad things happen, but yeah, you know, let's check out. Let's see what we can do with this artificial intelligence and all that kind of thing. So I don't know. I mean, I'm of an age where I think like, ooh, I don't know. I'm concerned about this to some degree, but I do think, you know, a lot of these films and shows from that time sort of were a pre-echo of that. And this Prisoner in particular, because I think it encapsulated in, you know, 17 episodes, a world that we live in now. Not as much fun as the series, because it isn't the 60s, that it isn't kind of, well, it's all a bit wacky and kooky, but it's like, yeah, we don't, what is real now? We don't really know anymore, you know, or, you know, and there's people actively engaged in taking advantage and, you know, increasing that ambiguity about it and all that. So yeah, we live in the world that the Prisoner presented. Well in advance of it, but that's, you know, genius often does that, you know. It's, you know, it's it, you know, so, you know, what is it, to great things cast their shadows before them, and you know, artists with the antennae, you know, pick up on it, and they can see where it goes, and they often probably don't know exactly where they're going with it, but they're being carried with, you know, with the kind of idea and inspiration. And I guess that's the other thing too. I mean, he was an auteur, you know, McGoohan. Like, it was like, this is his thing. Mm-hmm. And I would think in that if it was financially a success, if it really went off in the States, maybe it would have continued, you know, more. Although I don't know, you know, what could you have done? You know, I haven't had a chance to watch it. Like, I think he said 7 episodes were sort of the best, and these that would tell the story. I've not had a chance to, and I don't know exactly. I mean, the DVD set that I have, I don't know exactly, you know, what sequence it is in compared to other sequences. So there's all that kind of thing too, you know, that you know, did you watch them in the right sequence and all that? So but you know, wasn't there a plan that he was supposed to carry on and like Drake travel like around the world and you know, go to different places, and then they'd be after him somehow to get him, like The Fugitive or something like that, you know, get him back or something. I remember reading that somewhere. There was some idea, but I mean, I think it is what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very much that. And it's like, at least what I've seen, I can't see like, well, you know, what would you do? Because we're here, we're talking about it. So, I mean, there must be, you know, I wonder, you know, do you have like Bayreuth, where you get like all the prisoner fans together and they watch all 17 episodes in a you know, a marathon kind of thing, and you know, I guess they have those societies that meet in Port Marion and
There's the number 6 festival in Port Marion every summer, and
but I agree with you. I think that it is self-sufficient as it is. I mean, you don't really need to go any further than what McGoohan did in 1967-68. I think it's like, I mean, people now continue to talk about Twin Peaks, continuing Twin Peaks after season 3. And I personally think that all's been said. I mean, you have to be
quadruplet beaks then, right?
Yes, exactly. I do agree with the fact that, you know, sometimes you don't need to say more. I mean,
there you go. That makes it a work of art. It's self-complete, and you go back to it again. You know, so who knows? Maybe 10 years from now, I'll watch it again and all of that. One of the interesting things that I did come across was that the comic book artist Jack Kirby, who I was a great fan of, you know, this guy with Stan Lee created the Fantastic Four and, you know, the Iron Man and Thor and all that sort of thing. It must have been in the 70s or the 80s, but he had planned to do a comic book version of The Prisoner. And then it got you know, sort of dropped, but there are you know, sketches. And he had done one of 2001, I know, in the 70s as well. So that would have been interesting. It would have been interesting what his sort of rendition of it would have been. So I think it is very much what it is, and you know, just leave it there. Don't touch and try to turn it into, you know, something else. And because it's the sort of thing you can be endlessly interpreted, you know. And I'm sure I forget their names, but I know there were certain theorists, you know, in that world, and they argue with each other, and you know, this no, he's absolutely wrong, and all that kind of thing. And it's like that's the great thing. You create this whole, you know, well, in the UK they have the word anorak, you know, for someone who's a real, you know, devotee of one of those sorts of things. It comes from the jacket they sort of wear. And it's like that you get down to the minutia, little tiny, tiny details and all that sort of thing. And that's, so you've created a real myth, you know?
Yeah. And I find it uncanny the ways in which The Prisoner both reflects the time in which it was made, with some obvious political associations, of course. But I also was thinking about some of the episodes that you cited and certain themes that come up in them and how extremely relevant they are today. As you've already mentioned, you talked about the chimes of Big Ben, and there's the wooden partition that separates Patrick McGoohan from the woman who clearly has an Eastern European accent. And it feels like a direct visual symbol for the divide between East and West, which we sadly are still experiencing today, with various political and cultural battles. And I also thought about the surveillance society that we see that seems so incredibly innovative for the time, but this idea of constantly being watched and not having any privacy, no separation of private and public space in the village. So I'm just wondering, having grown up with the prisoner and having lived in the political climate of the 60s and having witnessed then what comes and what follows and what we're living through today, how do you feel about the politics in the show and how that may have shifted for you as a viewer?
Well, I mean, I was a kid, you know, when I first watched it, so I wasn't too, you know, politically minded. But having lived in London now for 28 years, it is the most watched city. You know, it has, you know, there's, you know, CCTV cameras everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's all over the place. So it's ironically, you know, even before The Prisoner, Orwell, Big Brother. I mean, that again, it's like, oh my, yeah, of course it's a cliche and all that, but the most, you know, one of the most, I don't know if it's on anymore, but one of the most popular reality TV shows is Big Brother. But oh yeah, I always get the feeling, okay, is that saying, oh, you guys, you were so hysterical then about all this, but oh, to us it's like, well, we're way beyond it or something. Like, or, you know, do they even have that amount of thought? And it's just like, yeah, this is, oh, Big Brother's watching you. Yeah, well, no, you're watching Big Brother now. Oh yeah, that works. You know, so, you know, but I just, it's the sort of thing, which it's a cliche, but it's like did you get it, you know, at all? But no, but I, you know, I walk around, if you walk around London, you see, you know, and if you look for them, but if you don't look too much, because they notice you looking at them, they'll get in touch with you. They'll ask you, why were you looking at that camera? You know, blah, 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 you know. So, but it's, and more, I mean, so there is, and it is eerily for me becoming, as I said, I'm of an age, and it's eerily for me becoming so much like what I would see as a movie about the future. I mean, even like shopping malls. I mean, they all, if you ever watch, you know, Logan's Run, it looks like, oh, yes, it takes place in a shopping mall. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but this was before there were those sorts of things, so it's all that. But no, it's eerily like that. And even now, like on the underground, you know, on the tube, and I understand why they're there, but there are all these signs about, you know, I guess a variety of different how should we say, offenses that you just to remind you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that and you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that. And there's also these ones like, if this happens, try to do this and try to do that. It's like, try to interfere. It's like, and I always wonder, yes, okay, I understand, yes, if someone's being attacked, I should help them, but who is going to help me when I get my head handed to me? Yes. You know, again, you just want, it's sort of like, it's all these little social instructions, and it's sort of, it reminds me, like, this is, I've seen this in a movie.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Somewhere, but this, it's not a movie. This is, you know, life and, you know, the, you know, getting to the end of the first quarter of the 21st century. So I don't want to sound like a Cassandra or something like that, but it just seems eerily like that to me. So yeah, I mean, that's in that political sense, I think he was very much, and also all the other things, you know, the credit cards, the cordless phones, and it was, you know, all this kind of stuff that, you know, again, was odd, you know, even though the phones were huge, but still the first ones we had were like that anyway. You know, it seemed that he, so yeah, you know, this was stuff that, you know, he picked up on, or, you know, maybe it seemed like, yeah, eventually this would happen. But no, that's the thing that I think is, and I, McEwen must have, well, I guess he was living in California, was that towards the end of his life? So it'd be hard to have CCTVs in California because nobody walks in Los Angeles, you know, like, you can follow the cars. That's why they have the helicopters and all that. So, but I don't know if he was aware that London had become like that. So, I mean, I don't know, is Paris like that? Do they have as many?
There's a decent amount of them, but not as much as in the United Kingdom. But what is always shocking to me is that we have so many CCTV in Western Europe, which is basically the safest place on the planet, and so little in the United States and other much more dangerous areas.
But they'll say, well, it works.
Yeah.
It works. You're so safe because we're watching you all the time, and you know, but no, I know, I know. So,
You're
but yeah, I mean
underground. Well, go ahead,
sorry,
sorry.
go, no.
No, I was just going to say your underground experience reminded me that we've replaced be seeing you with what is it that they say? See it, say it, sort it.
All right, see it, say it, sorted. That's right. That's right. Well,
Yeah.
this says if you see anything strange, and it's like, but do you have an hour? Oh, hold on, I'll tell you how many strange things. Do you really want to know? Or it's like, you know, or at the supermarkets where they say, what is it? An unexpected item in the checkout, and that's me. I always think so.
Oil-based fruit.
Yeah. So, well, you know, but no, I mean, again, it's it is it strikes me as very much, you know, like that. So, and I'm sure we can find, you know, maybe not exactly the same sorts of things. We could probably find similar sorts of echoes in some of the other, you know, products from that time. But I mean, it's the Philip K. Dick though thing now. I mean, that's the world where it's that plus all the paranoia. You know, so you know, you don't get, you know, I mean, Six doesn't come across as, you know, a paranoid kind of character. He comes across as someone who's, he's determined, you know, he will not give, you know, he's, you know, God, what's the, Bartleby the Scrivener, who says, I'd rather not, you know, he just, you know, I refuse. So, whereas then the different heroes in the, or anti-heroes in the Dick sorts of things always seem, you know, they're all rather wild and hysterical, and you know, things are popping up around them all the time. So it's a more heightened kind of you know, atmosphere with the same kind of, you know, ambiguity about reality, but it's and much more, you know. And now the technology is even, you know, as you say, the technology we have today, you know, create is this enables that at I would say an alarming rate. So.
So, do you think this means that we did not truly listen to what those authors were telling us in the 60s and 70s?
When do we ever listen to anything? You know, I mean, you listen later. You know, some people listen, some people get it. People in power usually don't. And if you think about it, well, that makes sense because they're in power because they don't listen. In power because they're, you know, they. You know, they, you know, they're, and they want power too. So, and it's always, I guess, in that context, it's always, you know, the immediate, you know, the immediate gain or the immediate, it's dealing with the immediate thing rather than the long range, you know, kind of consequences of it, you know, which, you know, the visionaries are the ones who are aware of that, and artists among them, and they can see it coming, and I would say they hope, and I think McGowan, you know, wants to affect change through persuasion and intelligence and reaching out and creating an atmosphere of asking questions and doubt and uncertainty, which is uncomfortable. But if you're uncomfortable, you'll do something, you know, to change, to make yourself, you know, not necessarily more comfortable, but to make, you know, somehow, you know, solve the problem. So. But that's a slower process, you know. But I would say that's what the artists in general do, you know, the ones who are interested in that kind of thing in some way, kind of persuade, you know, show what the problem might be, and perhaps offer a kind of, although, you know, some of the people they show what the problem is, and they say that's it. There's nothing we can do, you know. There's nothing to be done. You know, you have, you know, the Samuel Becketts of the world and people like that, or you know, it's just like this, and I'll show you how it's like this, you know, over and over again. And we can, you know, commiserate together, but you know, don't expect anything to happen. But you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, it's May 68, you know, it was happening around the same time as the prison and all that, and that was certainly a kind of revolution of the imagination. Take your dreams for reality and things of that sort. So I think, you know, again, not necessarily any direct connection, but part of a similar kind of, what do you want to call it, wave of kind of wave of change, imagination, and trying to see things differently against, you know, crashing against the, you know, the shores of, you know, whatever, complacency. My God, that was horrible. But if I wrote that in something, I would edit it out, but it's okay.
But what is interesting about the prisoner, I think, is that the people in power I mean, number one is basically number six. I mean, what does it say about the people in power?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Do you think? You say number six is number one. You would say.
I mean, you do.
But some of them say number one was the rocket. You know, and he even says at some point, "I want to be the first man on the moon." It's supposed to be, but that just seems like something they had to put into like, let's end this thing, because it doesn't seem like to me like this is always about like Britain wanting to put the first. They already got there. H.G. Wells had put somebody on the moon already. You know, Cavour. You know, I have to say if that's the big denouement, I kind of felt a little like, oh, I even forgot that happened in a way, because it just kind of goes off, you know, it's like a Monty Python thing. It just kind of goes off in the background. And then, so I didn't buy that, but I personally felt that was something they just threw in because maybe the producer, somebody thought we need to have something like that, you know? Otherwise it's this, you know, some James Bondy kind of thing, but what happens? Where does the rocket, it crashes, right? It doesn't quite make it, but.
Well, we don't see actually what happens to the
rocket. That's the thing. I'm trying to know what happens to the rockets. That's what I mean. It's just kind of, oh yeah, the rocket goes off. Okay.
But we do see briefly.
Napoleons.
Yes. But we do see briefly the person, under the mask revealing his face, and it's the same as
yes.
And I thought that was interesting, as if he had a doppelganger or a dark side of his own personality that was also doing this to himself.
Yeah. Well, oh yeah. Well, I see that. Yeah. I understand that. Yeah. Well, I mean, who is number one other than yourself? You know, looking out for number one. I mean, you know, are we all? Well, he was looking out for number one, and aren't we all looking out for number one in a certain way? So I mean, in that kind of sense. But yeah. Well, I guess. But that's the sort of, I guess, okay, we can. This is a, yes, that's right. It's profound, but it's also kind of a common trope. You know, you're looking at it's the mirror, and the mirror is you. It's like, oh, something like that. It's like, yeah, but it is who. But you're right. You asked this earlier. Who is he? He never says his name at the one time. It's Peter Smith, you know, and it's when he's trying to get back into his flat there and all that. But that sounds like John Doe, right? Or could have been anything, you know, we don't know. And even if he was Drake, he's not going to say it. You know, why would he say that? You know, he's haven't given away any information, you know, before. So why would he give away any real information then? So, yeah, there is, you know, it is this intense quest for identity. They want to know who he is, and he wants to know who he is, but he wants to know who he is before they know who he is. And he doesn't necessarily want to tell them once he does know. But in the end, he's friends with, you know, sort of friends, you know, or fellow travelers, certainly, or fellow escapees with, you know, Leo McKern and Angelo Muscat, you know, and Alexis Kanner, right? So, you know, they all kind of, I shouldn't say, they've bonded in a certain way through that, you know, through that experience.
And it seems important to somehow to demonstrate that he's not just an individualist, that he's willing to act and collaborate with others when it's something constructive, when it's not in a totalitarian setting, that he is willing to collaborate. And I'm so glad that you mentioned Alexis Kanner, because I think of all the other performers besides Patrick McGoohan, he just gives such a stunning performance in several episodes, and he's just got such a strong presence. And we mentioned the countercultural movement of the 60s earlier, and for me, he just completely embodies that in the last episode. What do you think about Alexis Kanner's character?
He struck me as someone from, you know, who represented that, I mean, the top hat kind of thing, you know, and all that, you know, sort of thing too. So I mean, it was a sort of, well, I guess he's supposed to be the counterculture, you know, hippie, but all that, but he's appropriating the dress of the established, you know, the high society and all that kind of thing. So that, you know, again, that's a sort of, you know, saying something and breaking of the boundaries and all that other thing. But I just wanted to say, just when you were saying about him, you know, willing to work together, that whole episode where he runs, you know, for the government, and he's trying to get people, you know, to join, to work together and all that kind of thing. He's reaching out to them. So he's not necessarily only out for himself or to free himself. He you know, he wants to help others as well. But again, I guess that the thing that he learns is, who do you trust? And again, you know, those guys, you know, Alexis Canada, Liam Recurrent, and all those guys, they're in the same kind of situation. You know, they don't know whether they can trust him as well. But no, I think he gave a good performance. And, you know, I mean, I don't know how many people can keep up them bones, you know, for that long without it getting, you know, a little detroit, but it was like he managed to pull it off. Did he choose that? Did McGowan choose that? It's, you know, it's an old spiritual and all that kind of, was it just sort of some wacky, you know, at the moment, okay, go for it, you know.
I just know that Patrick McGowan has gone on record as saying that for him, Alexis really embodied the countercultural movement. He loved his kind of anti-authoritarian stance, which I think you can just feel so well in that last episode. Like, he is just functioning on another level from the rest of us. You know, he's just not interested in this kind of banal, everyday regulation. What I appreciated so much.
Well, it's interesting McGowan would say that, because again, he comes across as rather conservative, you know, character, you know, certainly, you know, about sex and you know, I don't know, I get the impression he was a heavy drinker. I don't know what his ideas about drugs were or anything like that, but so I don't know, you know, if he himself, well, he must have made references to that, you know, in interviews about it somehow, that this, you know, maybe in some way, that what was happening, you know, in the 60s then in some way was a reflection of the kind of issues that and concerns that he was dealing with in the program.
I was wondering if you had something to say about the use of the music, especially in the last episode, which is so powerful, about the way it uses the Beatles among other. It comes as a surprise after the duration of the series, and then you have this very, you can see actually when he walks to his throne, several jukeboxes with records being put on play. So did you have something to say about this aspect?
Well, I mean, first off, the theme music was one of the great themes of, you know, it's up there with the Avengers theme music, I would say. It's like, I found myself, I didn't watch, re-watching it again, I didn't skip introduction. I didn't do that because I wanted to hear it. It's an interesting piece of music too. I mean, it's like a ba ba ba. He just does a lot with ba ba ba. He does ba 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 in different sorts of ways throughout that whole theme, and it just really works. One of the things I wanted to say before I forget, in the very first episode of this edition I have, when he's going into the underground car park. He actually, the car goes below the barrier. And then when he pushes the door open into, you know, into the office, it says way out at the top. So he's going through the exit way. And I never saw that in any of the other episodes. But those are so obvious. You know, he's going under the radar, and he's going, you know, he's going up the down staircase, as it were. So he's obviously a maverick and a rebel. But again, that just... thinking of the theme music that came to me, but yeah, it's, you know, using, I mean, it's a, you know, real satire. All You Need Is Love and all that. I mean, that was sort of like, okay, he's aware, maybe he's aware of the counterculture, but he also probably knows that that's a bit naive. I would think, you know, that, you know, you don't, you know, you can't do without love, let's say, but it's not all you need, you know, it's not the only nutrition. It's there's other, you know, man does not live by love alone, we might say, you know, and that kind of thing. And that itself was even, you know, more radical than just bringing in the counterculture stuff. That was like a certain, you know, a critique of a kind of children's crusade naivete about much of the counterculture, which, you know, it gives it its charming, you know, side to it, but it's also something that it seemed, you know, that's why it you know, exploded, you know, 2 years later or whatever. No, I think, you know, and it also related it to contemporary time. Not to say, I mean, it's not necessarily timeless, but we don't exactly know exactly when it's going on, you know. We don't quite know exactly when it's going on. It starts out okay. We see him in London, but that you know, that's that Buckingham Palace Road has looked like that for quite some time, right? So it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, contemporary. So, but bringing in the music then does make it very contemporary and very much of the moment. And at the end, and I guess it's also like, let's go for it, you know, let's have the big finale. Yes. Let's pull out all the stops and, you know, shoot off all the fireworks, you know.
And I'm not a music specialist, but am I right in thinking that there are some sounds that they may have riffed from Mission Impossible? There's a sound effect, for example, when usually there's some kind of attack, there's going to be a conflict or a fight, and you hear that dun 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 dun.
I have to go back and okay. The reason, go back and look. No.
I don't know.
But also struck me is that there is that kind of what do you want to call it? Music concrete kind of thing. It's like these kind, you know, sorts of things, which is that would have been very strange. You know. And I thought, I didn't catch that. I wouldn't have caught that the first time around. It's like, oh yeah, this is, you know. And then he brings in what is it? Is it during the political? Was it All for One? Is that what that one? And they had this, that kind of like marching tune. Yes. It's almost like The Great Escape, not quite, you know. So, but, which is, did they know that was like that? You know, You know, I mean, when I was a kid, that was like one of the big, you know, World War II. It was on two nights. You know, it was such a long movie. I had to watch it one night, and part two was on the other night, and had that great theme, you know, and had all, you know, Steve McQueen and James Coburn and, you know, all these different people, David McCallum, Ilya Kuryakin. In any case, I'm drifting off, but that, as I was watching it, hearing that, I wonder, did they know that? Because it sounds a little, and that would have made sense. Great Escape, you know, getting out of the, you know, the village, right, kind of thing. But it is something that comes up later on. They use that in a couple different episodes, and it is like a motif, you know, it's like a sort of Wagnerian motif that comes in. And no, I think he knew what he was doing. Although it sounds probably like, okay, stuff happened and they used it. Which means real creativity was going on, you know, the magic happens, but it's all of a piece, you know. I mean, the music struck me as not just music, just mood music to go, oh, something suspenseful, ooh, something, you know, it seems to be saying something about what's happening in the scene at the time. So I think it's a conscious, you know, contribution to what's going on.
Yeah, it sounds like there are a lot of intertextual kind of references happening within The Prisoner and with the music. I haven't seen anyone really do a lot of research about that. That might be a really interesting thing for one of our listeners to pursue if they want to look into trivia behind these different musical bits that we hear throughout the series.
Can you tell us about what you're currently working on? What's coming up soon?
Right. I've got a book coming out. Comes out in the States in June and the UK in July, and it's a biography of a fellow named Morris Nickel, whom I don't know. I don't think most people don't know who he was, but he started out as an early follower of Jung here in England. So about a century ago, he would have been a Jungian psychologist having a practice on Harley Street, which is a very prestigious street in London. A lot of doctors and, you know, have their practices there. But he attended a lecture by the Russian philosopher P.D. Uspensky, who had only recently come to London after being freed from a white Russian refugee camp in Constantinople. I'm telling you the whole story. But Uspensky was... he had become a surprise bestseller, a book of his translated in English, unbeknownst to him, while he was trying to escape from the Russian Civil War, had become a bestseller in the States and in the US, and an obscure book about, not an obscure book, but a book about metaphysics, a very kind of, you know, Tertium Organum, it was called. In any case, long story short, he winds up being brought to London. He's giving lectures. This guy Nickel attends one of his lectures, and he leaves Jung and he becomes a disciple of Uspensky. And then he goes and spends a year with Gurdjieff and in his Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man at the Prairie in Fontainebleau, just outside of Paris. And so I got asked to write the book because not too many people have Jung, Usmensky, and Gurdjieff for teachers, and I've written about all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But the strange thing was that not too long ago, a 1,000-plus page diary was uncovered by this guy.
Uh-huh.
And among many other interesting things in it, it becomes absolutely clear that he was totally obsessed with sex, which is not, you know, too surprising, but it was an obsession he pursued with one hand, if I can put it delicately, in that way. And it made for a very strange reading material to write a biography of this fellow with all this sort of thing. So we'll see what happens. It's bound to make some waves in the Gurdjieffian world. I don't know if you're familiar with the fourth way teaching. He lived in Paris during the 30s and during the occupation and all that. But in any case, that's coming out later this year. And I mentioned before I think you started recording, I have this map called In the Footsteps of Inspector Maigret. And it's a map. There are 40 different locations in the 75 Maigret novels, Simenon's Maigret. 63 of them take place in Paris, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's a map of 40 locations in Paris from the novels and stories. So a murder, you know, on the Saint-Martin Canal, and then, you know, something in Montmartre, and then something in Les Halles, and all this sort of thing. So it was fun to do. So that's coming out, with any luck, at the end of next month. So
wonderful.
We'll definitely look for that. And I just have to let you know that we're sitting in our flat in Paris, a 5 minutes walk from Canal Saint-Martin. So we'll definitely have to check out.
I have very fond memories. When my sons were little, we went there and we walked up to the big park, and there's the city of science thing up that way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I have some fond memories of that. Well, there you go. Synchronicity.
Yes.
That works. So
that's a map of the village as well.
Well, I don't know. There probably are. They've said if you have any other ideas. And when I was doing a bit of homework on this, I thought, oh, maybe not. But I thought, there must be already. So I don't know. But have you been? I've not been. Maybe.
Yes.
You've been to Port Marion?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
A wonderful place. Very unique. I think that it would be wonderful, even if the prisoner hadn't been shot there, because it is so, it's collecting architectural styles from all around the world and recreating this Italian.
It was postmodern before postmodern, right?
He was taking
bits and pieces before that and putting, you know, from other places and sort of bricolage kind of thing.
It works. Yeah. I mean, it is a very pleasurable, very enjoyable place that seems totally out of place, but at the same time very ingrained in this Welsh portion of the UK. It really is a wonderful place to visit. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I'll have to go.
I thought about it when you mentioned the fact that on one hand there are these elements of the 60s in the series, and at the same time it's difficult to say what time period we're in, and I thought that's also the Port Marion effect.
Yes.
Because it feels like this place out of time somehow that just has always been there, but we don't exactly know how it got there, but it's been there and it's timeless.
Well, those are the best places. Right. You always go back to them.
We usually close the podcast by asking our guest if there is perhaps a question we haven't asked that you think we should have asked.
Or if you wish we had asked.
Oh, let me think. I haven't thought of that. One thing we didn't mention was this sort of effect, whatever, they have this little trick where they have somebody play different roles.
Mm.
So you have the same face turning up, but they're in different identities again.
Yeah.
So that's another, you know, that's part of the whole, I guess, identity sort of thing. Also a part of the kind of rep, you know, that repertory theater that Ewing came from, you know, the sort of ensemble. Okay, just get out there, you know, and just go play the waiter for 2 seconds and come back in. So again, something that, should we say, was a necessity in some ways, I think, in an early part of his career, became, you know, something that it had an effect. It has this kind of strange, oh, wait, didn't I just see that, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, so that was just something that, you know, we might have mentioned, but we didn't. But there we go.
Yeah, that is one of the really fun aspects of the series. And we had mentioned how much Alexis Kanner is important to the series.
Yeah, he's,
he did have
he's
an uncredited role hopping in once to play a photographer in an episode.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having spent this hour and a quarter with us. We really appreciate all your comments about the prisoner. And
we appreciate your writing and your music as well. So thank you.
Oh, well. Well, absolutely my pleasure. And it was delightful. So, well, you know, maybe we can do it again sometime.
That'd be wonderful.
It would be a great pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images podcast on social media.
After Images.